You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. The work of Mike Nichols pervades American cultural consciousness. From The Graduate and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf to Angels in America, The Birdcage, Working Girl, and Primary Colors, not to mention his string of hit plays, including Barefoot in the Park and The Odd Couple. And if that weren't enough, he was also one half of the timelessly funny duo of Nichols and May, as well as a founding member of the original improv troupe. Over a career that spanned half a century, Mike Nichols changed Hollywood, Broadway, and comedy forever. But more than that, he changed many lives. Now, 150 people who worked with and knew Mike Nichols best recall the intensely human connections they had with the director in a new book by Ash Carter and Sam Kashner titled Life Isn't Everything, Mike Nichols as Remembered by 150 of His Closest Friends. And today, Sam and Ash joined me on the podcast to share what they learned about Mike Nichols' youth as a German-Jewish immigrant growing up in New York, the crippling illness that left him completely bald from boyhood on, and how it gave him a unique perspective on humanity that shined through in all of his films and plays. We discuss his early years as one of the founders of the improv group that would become Second City, the story of how he teamed up with Elaine May to form the comedy team of Nichols and May, and how their deeply personal and at times subversive act broke new ground in comedy. Sam and Ash also get into the creative differences that broke up Nichols and May and opened the door to Broadway and Hollywood for Mike Nichols. They reveal how the first-time director got the nerve to stand up to movie mogul Jack Warner during the filming of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, why he originally wanted to cast Robert Redford in The Graduate, and how Orson Welles tried to usurp him as director on Catch-22. They also talk about Nichols' courtship of the news anchor who would become his wife, Diane Sawyer, his lavish life, his many friendships, and a lesson in how to die with style. Coming up with Ash Carter and Sam Kashner in just a moment. Ash Carter is a writer and editor whose work has appeared in Esquire, Vanity Fair, Town and Country, and the New York Times. Sam Kashner is an editor-at-large at Airmail and was for many years a contributing editor at Vanity Fair magazine. He's also the author of several books, including the recent New York Times bestsellers The Fabulous Bouvier Sisters, The Tragic and Glamorous Lives of Jackie and Lee, and Furious Love, Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, and The Marriage of the Century. Now Sam Kashner and Ash Carter have teamed up to shed some light on the life of one of the all-time greatest directors of the stage and screen in their new book, Life Isn't Everything, Mike Nichols as Remembered by 150 of His Closest Friends. Sam and Ash, welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, great to be with you.
Just for the listeners, I had former Secretary of Defense Ash Carter on the show a while back, so I feel like I kind of have to preface this by clarifying for the folks listening here that this is not the same Ash Carter, by the way.
Yeah, it's a common mistake, though. In fact, there is a New York Times book review that mistakenly mixed this up, and they had to print a correction afterwards.
So. Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah.
Now, for anyone listening who might not know the name Mike Nichols, I guarantee that they know his work. He was the multiple EGOT winning director behind the original Broadway productions of Barefoot in the Park, The Odd Couple, Plaza Suite, Annie, The Real Thing, Hurley Burley, and Spamalot, as well as movies like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, The Graduate, Catch-22, Carnal Knowledge, Silkwood, Working Girl, Biloxi Blues, Postcards from the Edge, Regarding Henry, The Birdcage, Closer, Charlie Wilson's War, and Angels in America. Gosh, did you guys watch all of those when you decided to write this book?
Yeah.
Rewatch them, I guess?
Absolutely.
Yeah, some of them multiple times. And by the way, there's also his the first thing that he kind of became a household name for were his comedy album for the Lane May.
Yeah, and I want to get to those, you know, but at first I'm interested in the subtitle of this book because it sort of underscores how everyone seemed to feel that they had this intimate relationship with Mike Nichols and how in the every interaction that people had with him, whether it was personal or professional, whether it was over the course of decades or just a single film, everyone who knew him felt that they got something personal from Mike Nichols.
True. Well, he had a gift for friendship. He was, Ash and I often thought that we could call this book, you know, Seduced, because, I mean, he could be the most charming, seductive, entertaining, you know, the best dining companion you could imagine in New York, which is saying something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, so he did have these very often long-lived friendships and relationships with, you know, also equally complicated people. I mean, you know, Natalie Portman, who started to cry when she was remembering Mike. And,
really?
Yes, and Meryl Streep, who still to this day finds it very hard to talk about him without breaking up.
Yeah, one of his agents said that, you know, there's a lot of people in show business who can, they're sort of your friend as long as the movie's being shot and mm-hmm. then it's over. But that Mike had this gift for maintaining these, you know, what, and turning these relationships into genuine friendships. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there really was no, if any, we really had to cut ourselves off at a certain point because the we could have gone on. And if our publisher hadn't threatened to cancel our contract, we probably would have. So,
I mean, he was an incredibly considerate person too. I mean, I didn't know him terribly well, but I remember being in his house and admiring a first edition of The Letters of Oscar Wilde, for example.
Wow.
And 2 days later, there was a messenger with a package, and it was, you know, a first edition of The Letters of Oscar Wilde. I mean, you know, it could have come from his library, but also maybe not, you know.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
Very thoughtful person, yeah. You know, and we weren't great friends or anything, you know, but he had a very classy way of also showing his appreciation, you know.
And actually, I should say that, you know, part of the reason we wrote this book is that he didn't write his memoirs, but all the time he spent not writing his memoirs was spent in the company of these people. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I mean, this is a guy who had so many great anecdotes. It's kind of disappointing that he never wrote a memoir. And many of the people in the book say that they pleaded with him to write an autobiography, but he never did. Why do you think he didn't?
Well, there's different theories about that, and we let the different theories be aired in the book, but mm-hmm. but I think that he didn't like to he was known for, you know, he really lived in the present, you know, he was not somebody who just only wanted to tell great stories about old, you know, his early days in Hollywood and so forth. So I don't know. I think that he just was sort of always focused on whatever the next thing he was doing, and just, I don't know.
And I think you say in the book that at some point, I guess Diane Sawyer, who was his wife, said to him, "You can't talk about the past anymore. No more anecdotes from now on."
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, he directed that way too. I mean,
interesting.
Yeah, he. This was something that the great director Ilya Kazan sort of believed in too, was kind of a great presider for Mike in his relationship with actors, which is you kind of direct by sort of indirection, by anecdote, by revealing something about himself, you know. Natalie Portman told us that, you know, when they were making the movie Closer, you know, they would spend 2 weeks not talking about blocking a scene or even the characters, but about the actors' real love lives and romantic life.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I think Natalie Portman also said something along the lines of he would ask actors to name the moment in a scene. Mm-hmm. And it was a kind of a way of mapping out a play or a film. It's funny, for such a sophisticated guy, he seems to have really understood that a story only resonates if it taps into these most basic of human emotions. Mm-hmm. Where do you think that Mike Nichols got his emotional intelligence from?
From his childhood.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, he told his friend Renata Adler, who kind of had a similar background. So Mike's parents fled Berlin with him. I mean, they actually came over first, and he and his brother had to come over by themselves. But he told Renata Adler that when you're a refugee, you can read people's minds. This early experience just made him sort of hyper-attuned to human behavior, because that's how he needed to survive. And it was something he really carried with him for the rest of his life, and that distinguishes all of his work, I think.
And when did he come over to the U.S.? From where? Germany?
From Germany, from Berlin. In fact, he was 7 years old. I think his little brother, Robert, was 3, alone on this gigantic ship called the Bremen, which docked in New York from Berlin. In fact, Robert Nichols, who became a physician, Dr. Robert Nichols, told us one of the last echoes of Germany that they heard before boarding the ship was Hitler's voice over the loudspeaker.
Oh, wow.
You know?
Wow.
And that it always stayed with especially Mike, although he didn't talk about it that much, that they really just barely escaped with their lives. You know?
And it's interesting because you talk about how he kind of had two hits against him coming to America in the 50s, because he was both Jewish, but he was a German-speaking Jew. And so, you know, that was probably the least popular language in America at that point.
That's right. Yes.
That's right.
In fact, just off of the Bremen, early on when his father came to pick them up, he saw the Hebrew letters in a shop window, and he asked his father, "Is that legal here?"
Wow.
So I mean, on top of that, he is kind of stricken with some. It's not fully clear what caused it, but he gets alopecia when he's a young boy and loses all of his hair, which becomes a lifelong condition that he has to deal with by kind of painstakingly applying wigs every morning. And then his father dies when he's 10, who had previously been a pretty successful doctor. And, you know, so not only does he lose his father, but they also kind of lose their standing, and the mother's forced to really struggle to make ends meet, and their standard of living really plummets, and, you know, he spends the rest of his kind of adolescence in poverty, essentially. So it's a lot to overcome in his early life.
Yeah, later in the book, a lot of people talk about an interesting period in his life where he became obsessed with money, and he was just convinced that he was going broke, even though he had made all these hit movies and all these hit shows that were, you know, just pouring money into his coffers. Yet he thought that he was going to die broke, and he just would completely, people had to show him his finances, and that even that wouldn't convince him that he was secure.
Yeah, and
is that where that comes from in some sense? Kind of like depression era people?
Exactly. It's very common. People who who had that kind of depression experience as children, the fear never goes away. Mm-hmm. And that was definitely the case with Mike. And even though he became addicted to this sleeping pill with these horrible side effects called Halcyon. Like a lot of people in show business at the time, actually, the mania manifested itself in different ways with different people, and for him, it just brought out this kind of latent childhood fear of returning to the poverty of his youth.
How about the baldness? I mean, he was bald his entire adult life, or even before that.
As a child,
he lost all of his hair, all over his body, and he had to wear apparently wigs and toupees every day. In fact, I think that you said that he had a different toupee pretty much for every day of the week, and they were always perfectly groomed and all that. How do you think that shaped his personality and maybe even some of his work?
Well, I mean, his brother, Robert Nichols, said, "You can't understand my brother unless you understand the trauma of his losing all of his hair." And we mean eyebrows, everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, which he had to sort of paste on in the morning. It was just fundamental to who he was. And it didn't stop him from being popular in school as the boy with the baseball cap, you know. In fact, you know, I guess you can, I'm not a psychiatrist, but you can make the case that, you know, he needed to be as charming and seductive as possible because there was this sort of physical deficit in a way, you know. And also, this is a man who kind of worshipped beauty and was around, you know, this is the most beautiful people on the planet, you know, as the director
Taylor,
of actors.
Yeah, Meryl Streep.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and I mean, several people said, you know, we all have to create ourselves. But in his case, it was quite literal. I mean, he literally had to create. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, this is not his original name, and he's kind of putting on all he's dressing himself in the morning, like up to including his hair and so forth. So I think he was just very aware of that side of human behavior and it kind of people creating themselves because it was so dramatized in his own case.
And I want to talk about the early days of the creation of Mike Nichols. He goes to college at the University of Chicago, and that's where he gets into improv at the very beginnings of improv. And he eventually ended up co-founding what would become Second City. What was it about Chicago at that time in the 50s, and particularly U of C, that made it a prime breeding ground for improv?
Well, so he actually was not involved in Second City, although there was he would often put that in his bio. But Paul Sills was the co-founder of The Compass and Second City, so there's definitely a lineage there. I mean, the people who were at Second City worshipped Mike, and that also includes the founding cast of SNL. You know, Lorne Michaels told us that the Compass really kind of led directly to the creation of SNL in certain ways. But the University of Chicago is a very unique place at the time. It had one of the youngest college presidents in America, this guy Robert Hutchins, who was just hyper-intellectual. He got rid of the football team and basically reoriented what had been kind of a middling school onto the Great Books program. And he had this policy where anybody could get in if they passed this test. And so you had some people who were, you know, really young, like in their 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, and then also soldiers on the GI Bill. So you'd have somebody 16 and somebody who's 30 in the same classroom. But basically the group who started this thing, they were all just kind of very precocious group. They really read all these books. They started out, you know, doing all the classic plays, and then they just kind of being influenced by kind of, you know, Beckett and Brecht and things like that. And I think they actually staged they were some of the first people to stage Brecht in America.
Really?
But so the Compass was formed by these two guys, Paul Sills and David Shepard, and Shepard is very political, Sills is very avant-garde, but they did not intend for improv to be a comic form. And it was really Mike and Elaine May and Shelley Berman who just had these you know, just innate comic gifts who made it a comic form, which is, I think, what many people think of it as today.
So. Yeah, and I have to ask, of course, about the comedy team of Nichols and May.
Sure.
And I just love the story of how he and Elaine May meet. I think that they briefly were introduced backstage once, and I think someone warned him about her or something. And then a few days later, I think, they run into each other, and that's when they really meet. And it's almost like a perfect movie moment, how just everything seems to fall into place with them. Can you tell that story?
They met improvisationally, really, in a way.
I mean,
at a train station where Elaine was already seated, but they started in a way sort of improvise a kind of spy spoof, you know, where he said, "May I sit here?" You know, and Elaine would say, "You know, if you wish," you know, like they were like it was an assignation of two agents, you know, and Ash.
Yeah, and that routine, by the way, wound up on one of their records.
Oh,
but they kind of improvise all the way home, and they just were, you know, as their future manager Jack Rollins would say, ham and eggs. It was just like a match made in heaven from the very beginning. And other people in the theater would say, you know, true improvisation just means kind of being in the moment and not, you know, you're not supposed to just go for a laugh, but they were just so verbally gifted and could just kind of, these one-liners would just come pouring out of them. And in fact, later, they had this, so when they left the Compass and were doing, you know, the nightclub circuit in New York and later on Broadway, they would close their act by taking a request from the audience. And so they would ask for a first line, a last line, and a style.
Yeah. And the style shows just how highbrow these guys were, how intensely literate they were. Because when they say style, they mean the style of Shakespeare, or the style of Ibsen.
Tennessee Williams or Moliere.
And, you know, that shows you, in a way, how the culture's changed. Because as Jules Pfeiffer told Ash, you know, you're not going to hear people, if this were done today, yell out, "In the style of Henry James, Tolstoy," you know, it's just, forget it. It's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, their first sketch that really hit big was something called The Teenagers. Why was that so groundbreaking in that era?
Well, Ash loves that sketch, so he's...
First of all, I don't know if you remember in The Graduate, when in the first scene where Benjamin is kind of, you know, rented this hotel room and he's in there with Mrs. Robinson and he's feeling a little awkward, and she takes a puff of her cigarette and then he kisses her and then releases and she lets the smoke out after. That bit of business is actually from that teenager sketch.
Oh, wow.
But basically it was considered very groundbreaking at the time because it was a recognizably human scene that was about sexuality in a way that was really not done at the time. I mean, if you think back to 1950s television, you know, if any scene in a marital bedroom is they're sleeping in separate beds with, you know, full pajama sets, and it just really didn't reflect people's real experience. But the way that they so that they're playing two teenagers, you know, in a car, and he's kind of, you know, trying to get her to put out essentially, and it was just done in a way that was so funny, but funny because it was so uncomfortably recognized. You know, you could recognize your own experience in what was being put on stage,
and they were not afraid to show, however, in the most embarrassing human moments, you know. I mean, when in that sketch, when Lane says, you know, "But you won't respect me," you know, and he'll say, you know, and he said, "No, no, I'll respect you like crazy," you know, that Ash is right. That wasn't done then. And also these other themes, you know, that they're another famous, wonderful sketch. You can see it on YouTube. Of the cheap funeral. You know, this was the era also of books like The American Way of Death and Was the Loved One, you know. These were areas where it's one thing in literature, but to put them on in early television or even in nightclubs is extraordinary. Yeah.
Maybe their signature sketch was the rocket scientist on the phone with his mother.
Yes.
And in a way that encapsulates the difference, what a revolution in comedy this was at the time, because, you know, as so many people told us from, you know, Woody Allen and Tom Lehrer, like the previous generation were, you know, guys like Bob Hope and Alan King who would make a mother-in-law joke, but you couldn't make a joke about your mother. And so, you know, that was a kind of a bada boom thing with the punchline. And what they were doing, since they didn't come from vaudeville or the Borscht Belt, they had a theater background. So they were really doing these scenes. And, you know, they were both kind of part of this craze for Freudian analysis that was sweeping the Eastern Seaboard at the time. And so that sketch that they could sort of do something about, you know, your own relationship with your mother, you know, the woman who gave you life, who was seen as this kind of sacrosanct figure in 1950s America, and be so ruthless about it on you know, both her and the son, and just so penetrating in terms of just this dysfunctional dynamic. It was really not anything that anybody had seen before at that time.
Yeah, I guess it was sort of the invention of the archetype of the Jewish mom guilt trip.
Absolutely.
Sure. And you know, that sketch we learned in the book, you know, in doing research for the book, it really had its basis in Mike's relationship with his difficult, if not impossible, mother.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, the first line of the sketch came from an actual call he received from his mother, I don't know if you're familiar, but the sketch begins.
I think
she says, "Hello." And so, anyway, that Mike one day gets a call. He answers the phone, and there's this voice in the other end that says, "Hello, Mike. This is your mother. Do you remember me?"
And it must have been such a departure from kind of the traditional tuxedo comics who worked in the nightclubs in the 50s. And when I listen to old comedy albums, I do find that Nichols and May are way more timeless than other comedians of their era, because it's tied to human emotions, not current events or topical things.
You're in good company, or he is, because Paul Simon feels as you do, that he said, you know, "I used to worship Lenny Bruce, but Lenny Bruce actually seems more dated to me," he said, than Nichols and May. Yeah.
Wow.
And while we're talking about this shift in comedy, I mean, one thing Lorne Michaels told us was that, so, you know, he's a whatever teenager in Canada at the time, and said that of this group, you know, Nichols and May among them, of comedians, that this is really the first. They're as opposed to the previous generation of comedians, that where you had joke writers and performers, these are writer performers, and it's a little bit analogous. Right. And this is what Lauren said, to what was going on in music, where suddenly you've got these, you know, groups like the Beatles who are both writing and playing the songs, and it just completely changed our expectations for kind of what it meant to be a comic, and he really credits that to that being like the beginning of what led to SNL.
Yeah, I think Jack Rollins, the entertainment manager in here, who represented Woody Allen and Robin Williams and Nichols and May and a lot of big people, he tells a story of how Woody Allen approached him and said, "Hey, you know, I really, really want to write for Nichols and May," and he's like, "I'm sorry, they write their own material."
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
No, I mean, in fact, I mean, Woody, that's the, so that meeting, you know, he says, "Well, would you represent me?" And he says, Rollins says, "Well, we don't represent writers, but we'll give it a try." And Woody would kind of come in and read his material in the office. And Jack Rollins just found it's so funny the way that he did it, even though Woody never thought of himself as a performer up until that point, and he practically pushed him on stage. So, you know, that's the beginning of Woody's career is really right there in that office, him trying to audition.
That's incredible.
For Nichols and May.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more when we come back in just a minute. For over 15 years, Oris has been making purely mechanical watches in Holstein, Switzerland. Staying true to a rich heritage, Oris is one of the few Swiss watch companies to remain independently owned and operated. Because of that independence, Oris has the freedom to follow its own path. They're focused on bringing change for the better, which means making choices that are ecologically, socially, and financially responsible. That includes ocean conservation and recycled plastic partnerships. Of course, that's along with Oris's more than century-long commitment to making inventive, high-functioning Swiss-made watches that serve a real purpose, at a price that makes sense, the best possible watch for the money. Comprised of four themes, diving, aviation, motorsport, and culture, Oris watches are made for everyday wear. Shop the many different unique styles at oris.ch/kick. You're sure to find one that's your style and suits your taste. That's oris.ch/kick. And now, back to the podcast. And some of the people in this book talk about the fact that Elaine May wanted to be a pure improv act. And Mike, of course, being the director type, wanted to script out their sketches. And she would sometimes drive him nuts when she would go off script. Was that what eventually led to their breakup?
Yeah, I mean, she didn't want anything to get stale. You know, she grew out of improvisation. And that's why they weren't, even though they appeared on an early television show called Omnibus, which was, you know, kind of helped make them kind of a household name, but they weren't great in a way great on television. She balked at it. She balked at the sameness of it, the repetition. I mean, he could have lived with it, I think. Mm-hmm. But it made her very restless and kind of claustrophobic.
Yeah, in fact, Bob Newhart told us a story about, so when they take their nightclub act to on Broadway, and it's this show directed by Arthur Penn, and he said that they needed to put their routines down on paper so that the lighting people would know kind of when to hit
right.
the cues.
Yeah.
And she comes over to Mike and says, "We can't do this sketch. It's not funny." And he says, "What are you talking about? This is one of our best routines." And she says, "It's not funny. I just saw it on paper." So that yeah. kind of gives you a sense of wow. what her attitude was.
And after the breakup, he goes through a little bit of a period of depression, and then he hits it big because he teams up with Neil Simon and directs three monster hits on Broadway, Barefoot in the Park, The Odd Couple, and Plaza Suite. And I found something really interesting that Neil Simon said in here. He said, I'm paraphrasing here, but he mm-hmm. said Nichols could find new depths of meaning in scripts that even he hadn't realized.
Yeah.
His scripts.
Yeah. He said you know, he'll never work with he was the best he ever worked with. And, you know, that I mean, it's important to point out, by the way, that Neil Simon was not Neil Simon when Mike teamed up with him. I mean,
he'd been on the show, your show of shows or whatever.
Exactly. He was a TV writer. And then he did mm-hmm. this one play called Come Blow Your Horn, which is, you know, was not a massive hit. So it was really the combination of those sensibilities that made those shows such phenomenal hits. I mean, there was a point where there were three of them running on Broadway at the same time, which was totally unheard of.
Wow. Yeah, now he comes off of these monster hits on Broadway and goes to Hollywood to direct Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? This was his first movie, mm-hmm. yet he's able to get Jack Warner to agree to give him 6 weeks of rehearsal, which was totally unheard of in Hollywood.
Yes.
And at one point, Warner wants to make the film in color, and
right.
Nichols insists on keeping it in black and white. He gets away with it. Where did this guy, this first-time director, get that kind of chutzpah?
Well, he was, you know, incredibly willful, and he was also young.
But you should explain how he linked up with Elizabeth.
Oh, well, and also he had the tremendous good faith and clout of Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton.
Okay.
You know, the An Evening with Nichols and May and Camelot, wasn't it,
mm-hmm.
Were kind of cheek by jowl on Broadway. And
mm-hmm.
they would, you know, he and Burton would, you know, steal smokes in Schubert's Alley, you know.
Yeah.
And in fact, we begin the book with an excerpt from Richard Burton's diary, where he goes through all the sort of great figures that he knew, Churchill and
Picasso
and Somerset Maugham, and even Edward Albee, and you know who. And he calls it the Burton Stakes, you know, for sort of the greatest person he knew. And he kind of settles on, he decides it's a toss-up between Mike Nichols and Noel Coward, you know, that they were just so dynamic and charismatic. And,
yeah, both great wits, but couldn't have been more different. I mean, a waspy, gay Englishman and a Nebuchadnezzar Jewish immigrant from Central Europe who almost was obsessive over women.
That's true, although a lot of people invoked Coward with Mike because he was just such a bon vivant. He was so just the zenith of sophistication, and he could speak in kind of these devastating epigrams, which is a very all kind of Noel Coward qualities. But, Maureen Dowd, in a way, kind of summed it up perfectly when she said that Mike was a Noel Coward figure with a Jerzy Gazinski pass.
So he has a huge hit with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and then he follows it up with perhaps his best film, The Graduate, which he won an Oscar for. But when he pitched it around town, no studio wanted to make the movie. Why not?
Well, so Larry Terman, who we actually just came from lunch with just now, but Larry's the one who optioned the book, and he brought it to Mike before he'd ever directed a movie. So at the time, just no studio would take a chance on him, essentially. Now, while he's
On him. Okay.
On Mike, because he just wasn't well known enough. And so while he's still struggling to kind of line up the money, Mike gets the Virginia Woolf job because of his relationship with Liz and Dick. And so by that point, I guess it was enough. But it was still really kind of an independent movie. Terman got this the guy who he affectionately refers to as a schlockmeister, Joe Levine, to put up the money, basically. And it was made for not a lot of money and made a hell of a lot of money on the other side. So,
and he originally wanted Redford for the lead,
yes,
right?
Robert
not Dustin
Redford,
Hoffman.
Yeah, and
Candace
Bergen auditioned together. I mean, it would have made more sense if they had, if they stuck to the original idea of the book about these actually wasps from blonde wasps from Pasadena.
Yeah.
But they decided to sort of flip it. Mike and Buck.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that you have a Jewish director, a Jewish writer, and a Jewish star making a movie about wasps in Pasadena.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't change the names of the characters or anything like that. They don't make any, but just by casting a Jewish actor and not Paul Newman either. I mean, this guy's nobody's idea of a leading man at the time, including his own.
Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah, he actually turned down the part at first because he said, "Look, Mr. Nichols, you want a guy like Robert Redford." And Nichols said, "You don't want to do it because you're Jewish." And Hoffman said, "Yeah." And Nichols said, "Well, maybe Benjamin's Jewish inside." And it was that's really not in the book. And it really, it would have been such a different movie if he had gone with the traditional leading man type anybody else would have gone with. But he just by putting a guy like Hoffman in that part, he closed the distance between the audience and the character. So instead of just looking up at some teen idol on the silver screen, this is a guy who they kind of can see themselves in a little bit.
It changed everything.
Yeah.
Now, after that, he does Joseph Heller's Catch 22. He brings that to the big screen. He casts Orson Welles in the film. What was it like working with such a big personality and someone who thought that he, and perhaps rightly so, that he was the greatest director of all time?
Yeah, well, apparently it was kind of hellish. I mean, Orson Welles, first of all, is in every conceivable way larger than life, and larger than anyone else.
Yeah.
And he thought he should be directing the movie. And finally, he got so kind of disgusted, he did something that he would have been appalled to do with any other, wouldn't have allowed it with any other director, which is, I think it was the scene where he's either, you know, pinning a medal on, you know, on I guess what would be a naked Yossarian, or anyway, he actually had Mike give him the line readings, you know, off camera, and I'll just do it exactly like you you tell me to, you know, it was, so it was really impossible. And then I think Bob Newhart told me he had a scene in which I'm probably screwing this up, but the idea was anyway he was. So I don't think it ever made it to the screen. But he was supposed to be sort of practically under a Jeep, and he kind of realized that Orson Welles was sitting on it, you know, sitting on the Jeep, which probably made it twice as heavy.
Yeah,
it's something like that anyway. So it was kind of a mixed blessing to have Welles there.
Sure.
No, and I mean, and when they weren't shooting, so Orson was there for 2 weeks basically because he demanded that all his scenes be shot in sequence, and. When the cameras weren't rolling, you know, Austin Pendleton, who is all he plays his sort of factotum, whose son, I believe, in the movie.
Yeah,
he says that they would just toss. Yeah. He described it as being like tossing fish to a seal, where they would just throw out a name of another director and see what he would say. And so, you know, they would say, "Oh, Stanley Kubrick," and Orson Welles would just go on and on about how overrated he was, and you know how he wanted to. You know, teach a class just so he could show his students everything that was wrong about Paths of Glory. And, you know, said, oh, 2001 had just come out, and he said, oh, life's too short. I'm not going to go see that. And he said, finally, Mike said, Orson, promise me you will not come to see this movie when it's finished.
Yeah. You know, if you'll indulge me, you know, Bob Newhart spoke to us, you know.
Yeah.
And he wasn't known as an actor at all. You know, it was another interesting, compelling kind of choice, you know, casting choice. And but Mike did ask, just as he asked Art Garfunkel, you know, to become an actor in a way, he asked Bob Newhart to play Major, and Bob Newhart says to us, "I was really surprised that Mike wanted me in Catch-22 because you were surrounded by really great actors: Alan Arkin, John Voight, Orson Welles, Richard Benjamin, Paul Prentice, and I was a stand-up comic. I wasn't known as an actor, so I took that as a compliment. They asked me to play Major, and we went down to Guaymas, Mexico, where they built an airfield over the Sea of Cortez. And curiously enough, Newhart was also offered a part in MASH, which was the movie that kind of undid the attention paid to Catch-22. But he turned it down because he felt kind of loyalty to Mike, who had asked him. And this, I thought, was fascinating. I remember one of the first things was Mike got us all together, the cast and crew, and he said, "You have to understand that you are figments of Yossarian's imagination," which was certainly a departure from the book. I just played it for laughs. But then the making of the movie started to take on a kind of surreal quality.
And so many people, Ella, like Bob Newhart and others, talk about just how much fun it was to work with him and what a happy experience it always was. It almost sounds like doing a movie or a play with Mike Nichols was kind of like attending this really great month or two long dinner party with him.
Yes, that's well said. Exactly.
I mean, not it wasn't always a joy if people were screwing up or you know, not meeting their marks, he could be pretty withering. Mm-hmm. But if people kind of really pitched in, then yes, it was a great experience.
Yeah, and I think that comes out with Working Girl. I guess at some point you say that Melanie Griffith says that she showed up drunk on set, and he actually asked her to pay, I think, something like, what, $80,000 in production costs?
Yeah, she screwed up the night's shooting, and they felt they had to punish her, or there had to be a consequence. Mm-hmm. And it cost her $80,000 30 years ago, you know. It's still a lot of money, but I mean, and she kind of learned a lesson from it. I mean, they, you know.
She credits that as being a real turning point in her kind of struggle with substance abuse thing.
Yeah.
And I mean, on the other hand, he could have ratted her out to the studio. And he chose to ask her to pay that instead of ratting her out to the studio, which that would have likely ended her career if he had done that.
But he could be and was his entire life ruthless about decisions affecting his work, mm-hmm. Stage and film work.
Yeah. Now, I have to ask about the woman who was his fourth wife and now his widow and the love of his life, TV news anchor Diane Sawyer. Apparently, he was obsessed with her even before they met, right?
That's right, yeah. Tom Styron, William Styron's son, told a story about Mike was over at their house in Roxbury, Connecticut, and suddenly 60 Minutes comes on, and this is right when she had just joined the show, and he was just kind of, you know, thrown back in his chair, said that's the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. And so Bobby Greenhut, who produced a number of Mike's movies, said that he was having lunch with Mike or something, and Mike said, "So, you know, I just had a date with Diane Sawyer." And Bobby Greenhut said, "Good for you. Do you get any?" But anyway, yeah, I mean, it really was he's a guy. So it's, I mean, we just, you know, Doug Wick, the producer of Working Girl, said that Mike had this real romantic side, which comes out in that movie, which he made while they were first going out. And so, but, you know, this is a guy who also made Carnal Knowledge and Heartburn. I mean, some of the really kind of most, hard to watch movies about just the horrible ways men and women can treat each other. But he said to many people he kind of finally got it right with her, and you know, you know they were married for how many years? So,
well, I mean, they married in 88, and he died 5 years ago, and it was, yeah, it's you know, he described himself as a Pinocchio, you know, but Pinocchio who became a real boy, you know, Candy Bergen and some other people called it the Diane effect on his on his personality, that it made him a better and nicer person. Peggy Noonan, you know, the columnist and speechwriter for Reagan. This is Peggy Noonan. I said to Diane once, we were talking about marriage, and she had by that point been married long and happily. And I said, "Oh, Diane, don't you think you were made to be married?" And she said, "No, I don't think I would ever have been married if I hadn't met Mike."
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, she is one of the few people who didn't participate in the book. I'm assuming that you did approach her, though.
Yes. Well, we certainly couldn't have done this book without her, in a way, her a kind of benediction, you know.
Oh, really?
The example we give is Samuel Beckett's response to his biographer, Deirdre Baer. She wrote him cold. She was a young writer. And he basically said, "I'm not going to help you, but I'm also not going to hinder you." And at the beginning, this was, I think, Diane's approach. But when we really needed her, when we needed her to kind of go deep into our bench and find somebody that we wanted to talk to, she was willing to be helpful.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, he had this rather charmed life, both in terms of the people he surrounded himself with, but also just the lavishness and the style with which Mike Nichols lived. What was it like to be Mike Nichols?
I wish I knew.
Well, you met him several times.
Yeah. Well, Candy Bergen said that he really, you know, no one really lives like that anymore, but he did live like a prince, you know. I mean, he bought and sold Arabian horses and would have kind of beautifully lit and choreographed horse shows, you know, two horse ranches, you know, one in Santa Barbara and the other was in Connecticut.
And quite an art collection as well.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I'll tell you quickly an anecdote. It's not in the book, involved me. I was at their home, and I thought I would kind of show off. And there was a painting. It was either hanging in the bathroom or right in front of on your way to the bathroom. And I came back and said, "You know, that really reminds me I forgot the artist's name now. All my proper nouns are going somewhere to die." But it might have been a Rothko, like a Rothko.
Okay.
And
I said,
"You know, that really reminds me of a Rothko." And Mike said, "Well, I hope so, because it is a Rothko." You know?
Yeah, no, his longtime assistant director told the story that they were having some meeting in the pre-production phase of some movie, and He was kind of meeting with the production designer and trying to explain what he wanted for the color palette of the movie, and was sort of struggling to find the words. And so he says to the assistant director, just bring in the small Matisse.
I love that story.
It's really extraordinary, the way that he lived. Yeah.
And it's ironic because at some point, I forget who says this, but someone recalls him saying, I'd love to know what it's like to be rich. He always felt that he needed more, and he just wanted to be able to acquire so many things. Do you think that he agreed to do some films just for the money that he maybe later regretted?
Certainly, there were some people who told us that. And, you know, those people who said that, they really only said it in a spirit of disappointment because they knew – they just felt there's nobody more capable and more brilliant, and it kind of hurt them when they felt like he was being compromised a little bit in his creative judgments. I mean, just to give an example, he was originally supposed to direct Remains of the Day, and
oh really?
Yeah, and
that's an interesting
choice. he asked the studio for $25 million to make the movie, which at the time, you know, nowadays in the era of like $300 million, it doesn't sound like much, but
that was
the time,
also for Merchant Ivory.
Exactly,
that was a lot of money.
This was a lot of money, way more than anybody else would have made that movie for. And so he is with his friend John Calley, who the studio head at the time. And John Calley says, "Let me ask you, does it make you nervous? Remains the Day, $25 million." And Mike says, "I can't sleep at night." And he says, "Well, why don't you just get out of it then? You know, because I'm telling you, the studio would rather you do Wolf." And so that's basically what he wound up producing Remains of the Day and directing Wolf. And, you know, that I don't know if that was such a great choice. So, but even though certainly we're not making the case that his filmography is without blemish. But at the same time, he was able to, he knew when something wasn't working, and in over and over again, kind of coming off of a failure would in a way lead to his next triumph. You know, his probably one of his most disastrous movies on set and least successful was What Planet Are You From, that Gary Shandling wrote and starred in. They did not get along on set, and it just, you know, was not a happy experience for him. He felt he kind of had gotten talked into doing the movie, although of course, you know, it's his choice in the end. But it was that kind of led him to start working at HBO and first with Wit and then with Angels in America, and kind of, you know, it was a real rebirth to his career. Those were jobs that paid a lot less than the kind of commercial movies he'd been doing. But, you know, it was important to him to get back in touch with the reason that he was doing this work in the first place, because it wasn't all about money for him.
Yeah, and some of his final movies were his best.
Yeah, and also, by the way, he as somebody told us, a lot of directors use theater as a stepping stone to get to Hollywood, but Mike, that was a parallel career all the way through, and that was not about money, because the money was not as big as it was in the movies, but that was just a kind of love affair that never just remained undimmed till the end. In fact, some of his finest work at the, you know, his Death of a Salesman production was a real kind of high point.
Right.
And in a way,
Philip Seymour Hoffman. Yeah.
And
which was really interesting casting at the time.
It was exactly,
because he was much younger than the role is written.
Yeah. I mean, Frank Rich said that, you know, just as nobody would have cast Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate, nobody would have felt Phil Hoffman was ready for Salesman. And it's a kind of callback to what got Mike interested in theater in the first place, because he saw, I believe, the second ever performance of that show, the original Elia Kazan directed production when he was a teenager. And he was just completely kind of, you know, changed his life, essentially.
I mean, we were also interested in our book, not about the glittering great success, you know, which he had, but also, how did he handle failure and disappointment? And you know, in a way, that's what the title is about, you know, because something was a kind of a motto of his when things didn't really go well, you know. Mm-hmm. And Joe Papp, the creator of the Public Theater and the famous producer, said of Mike early in his career, said to someone, you know, Mike Nichols is not a success. And the person said, why not? This is after some tremendous success. And he says, well, because he hasn't had a failure yet. And his brother, Robert Nichols, told us that when they asked Mike about it, he thought for quite a while without a comment and said, you know, it's true. You have to prove yourself by rising from the ashes. It's why he called his production company Icarus Productions, you know. you know, he sailed very close to the sun at the beginning of his career. Mm-hmm. But he kept at it, you know.
He reinvented himself, you know, many times and kept, you know, he would just coming back from the ashes, exactly.
Yeah. Well, before we wrap up here, you know, Mike Nichols just did everything with style. And his final weeks on this planet were no exception, really. And I think there's something wonderfully instructive in here about how he went out in the final weeks before he died. Can you tell us a little about that?
His last birthday, for example. So he died 2 weeks after his last birthday. And Christine Baranski, who he'd worked with first in The Real Thing on Broadway in 1984. Mm-hmm.
Tom Stoppard.
Called him up and said, you know, I've got a few days off from The Good Wife. Like, let me take you out to lunch for your birthday. And so he said, great. So then she called up Cynthia Nixon, who was also in The Real Thing, and said, why don't you come? And she said, great. And Cynthia said, why don't you call Whoopi? Because he had discovered Whoopi that year and took her to Broadway. And Glenn Close, who was also in The Real Thing, wound up coming. So Mike shows up at the restaurant, and here are these four actresses that he directed in the year 1984, which is 30 years before this birthday. Kind of, you know, all gathering to wish him a happy birthday. And, you know, she said the lunch went on for like 4 hours or something. And, he just, you know, he really went out with a full dance card.
Yeah,
you know,
He had all these lunches apparently with friends, connecting with people, laughing, talking for hours.
It became a running joke with Ash and myself that we would one of us would interview someone like Tom Stoppard or the artist Eric Fischel, and it would always be, you know, wait, he just had lunch with Mike a week before he died, and someone else would. And you know,
it's almost impossible.
Yeah, and, you know, Wally Shawn said, you know, it's a fortunate thing when you can die in a good mood.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, once again, the book is called Life Isn't Everything, Mike Nichols as Remembered by 150 of His Closest Friends. Sam Kashner and Ash Carter, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks again to Ash Carter and Sam Kashner for coming on the podcast. Order their new book, Life Isn't Everything, Mike Nichols as Remembered by 150 of His Closest Friends, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.